From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. There are roughly 7 million people in the American criminal justice system. A huge proportion of them are young and black. Sociologist Alice Goffman spent 6 years in one of America's toughest neighborhoods to understand it from the inside. She found plenty of violence, heartbreak, and crime. She also found a world living perpetually on the run, off the books, a separate America with its own norms and economy. This hour, On Point, the underground economy, America's war on crime, and life on the run. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you seen this world, lived it, on the run and off the books? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Philadelphia, where she has dug deep, is Alice Goffman, professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Her new book is On the Run: Fugitive Life in an American City. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. Alice Goffman, welcome to On Point.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to be here.
You're writing about life in an American city, but you say the book is an on-the-ground account of the U.S. prison boom. What's the connection?
That's right. So there's 2.2 million people in prisons across the country, but double that are living under supervision of the court, so on probation, parole, or people with low-level warrants, people living in halfway houses on house arrest. So we used to think that people got arrested, got sentenced, went to prison, and then came home with felony convictions, which we know makes it very hard in the labor market, makes it hard to get housing. But actually, there's this whole other shadow world of criminal justice involvement, where young people, before they go to prison and then after they come home from prison, are living, are going to court and trying to meet their parole requirements, or living with technical violations, with warrants, and in a poor community, of color like the one that I was in Philadelphia. There's a whole lot of people living like this, and their life is about dipping and dodging the authorities, trying to steer clear of the police, who are there in great force, rounding up people, making arrests.
You went out to tutor a young high school student in this neighborhood as a pretty young student yourself, a sophomore in college. You came back 6 years later with several seasons worth of stories for The Wire, if they were headed there. I mean, this is quite a picture. What are you trying to show us that many Americans just don't have much of a sense of? What did you find?
Well, like you said, I started out tutoring a young woman in high school when I was a student at Penn, a college student. And from there, I met her cousin, Ronnie, as he was coming home from a juvenile detention facility. And then through him, I met his cousin, Mike, who was a year older than me, 22. And a couple weeks after I met Mike, the police raided his uncle's house. He was apparently wanted on a shooting charge, although he had denied being in any shooting. They raided his uncle's house, tore the house apart, and then his uncle called him at his girlfriend's house and said they're going to be there next. So Mike spent a few weeks on the run, living with a warrant, and then scraped together enough money to pay a lawyer, turned himself in. Then his mother paid his bail, and then he came home and started attending these court dates for this shooting charge. And I just met him, and I thought, oh wow, this is a totally rare and significant and really big deal in his life. This is very serious. This shooting charge, right? He'd go to prison for a really long time. This must be a really big deal in the life of his family and his neighborhood, what's happening to him. And so we get to the courthouse, the first court date he had, this pretrial court date, and he just happens to know the guy standing outside, also waiting to go into court that day. They smoked a cigarette together, and I thought, oh, that's funny. He just happens to see a friend of his right outside the courthouse. And then he gets into the courthouse. We walk in together. And he knows, two-thirds of the young men sitting on the defendant's side. They're all from the neighborhood, and these are young guys dealing with probation violations or new charges. And they're not, they're not in high school. They're sitting in this courtroom. And it was like, oh, this is where young men in the community are. This is where young men are spending their time, So that just got me interested in this whole world of young men who are living in fear of the police and living with warrants and, you know, sort of they're not going to college and they're not finishing high school, going to college, getting jobs. You know, they're going to prison. So that's what got me started on this whole project.
There are two big narratives around this. I mean, one in this country is we had a terrible crime problem. Crime went up and up. There was a war on crime. The prisons filled, but crime went down. And crime is down. There's
right.
another,
right.
which
at,
is
at
yours.
An all-time low.
Yeah, all-time low. The other narrative, which you have very vivid illustration for here, is that we've created a kind of police state running through parts of this country. And crime is low, but a portion of society is being destroyed, oppressed, call it what you like. How do those two narratives fit together, or do they? Is each blind to the other?
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I think that second narrative is the story that I'm trying to tell, you know? So by 2002, in this neighborhood in Philadelphia, police curfews had been established around the area for people under 18. But what that meant was that anybody who looked under 30 could be stopped and searched. And then with stop and frisk, you know, that became more legitimated. Police video cameras were on major streets. The first 18 months I spent in this neighborhood, I was there every day and I took notes. So I watched the police stop pedestrians or question people or make an arrest, search people, run their names for warrants every single day in this 4-block radius except like 5 days. So I saw the police break down doors, search houses, chase people through houses, intimidate women, pressure them to inform on their friends and relatives, their brothers. 14 times in the first year and a half I was there, I saw the police punch, choke, beat, stomp on, strangle, beat with their nightsticks young men after they had cuffed them. So living in a neighborhood with this much police activity, you know, you really learn to fear the police, to run when they are coming. This was a very different view of the police than I had growing up in a middle-class white neighborhood in Philadelphia, and certainly different than, you know, anything I was seeing kind of in the media.
You call it a surveillance state that this community lived in, and you say, by implication, others across the country. You've begun to give us a sense of that, but take us further, the sort of weight of police presence and the application of surveillance and force.
Yeah, so there was this big increase in federal dollars going to urban police departments across the country in the tough on crime, zero tolerance era, which we're very much still in, but which, you know, there are signs we may be sort of easing out of. So that money, it really, a lot of it went to policing. So the numbers of police increased and also what they were doing changed. So there used to be, like in a poor community of color, like that sociologists have been writing about for a long time, you know, there used to be like a few corrupt, pretty racist sort of beat cops who were there to, you know, they were sort of pals with the local drug dealers or the neighborhood watch person. And, you know, they were mediating disputes, not very well, didn't really care. They had a kind of laissez-faire attitude. And that all changed in the 80s and 90s. So now you have, you know, what one young man I met, Mike, his mother described as an occupying force. You have sort of fleets of anonymous police in special units who go in and what their job is to make arrests, to make as many arrests as possible. This became the number of arrests became a kind of indication of good performance. So they're not arresting people en masse like. On college campuses, like Penn's college campus where I went to school, they're arresting young men in black neighborhoods, often for doing exactly the same things that men, you know, in college are doing.
Smoking
using
pot
drugs,
or
getting
in
fights.
A fight or something.
Exactly. Which is not to say that the levels of violence are not serious, but the kinds of arrests that people are going through are often these very small things.
People often look at this and say, come on, folks, let's just simmer down here, go get a job and just opt out of that game of cat and mouse and surveillance and arrest and the legal system. Don't go there. Get a job. Get away from that.
Absolutely, right? It's like, you know, anybody, you know, this is America, right? Anybody can get a job if they try. The thing is that for black men who have not finished high school, unemployment is at 60%. I believe it's 56%. So that means that that there are a lot of young men who are trying very hard to get jobs and who cannot find work. It's 26% for people who have finished, for African Americans who have finished high school. So those are really, really high unemployment rates, and that's not even counting the people who have become too discouraged and are not looking anymore. So some of the kind of saddest moments for me in this neighborhood were watching young men I had gotten to know try and fail to find like the lowest paying part-time work. So like I would watch Mike and his friend Chuck and other friends of theirs go out to Walmart and Kmart and Taco Bell and to look for work and not hear anything for months and months. So like one day Chuck got like too discouraged and hungry, and he had been living at his mother's house and not contributing anything financially to the household for months and months, and he just got to a breaking point and got some crack to sell on commission from somebody down the street.
You quote him saying, Chuck's got to eat.
Yeah, right. It was like I remember him cutting it and just being so angry at himself and at his own failures and at the world for selling drugs. You know, like he knows exactly how bad drugs are. He knows how likely it will be for him to get rearrested. But there he was without a job after, you know, 6 months and very little family support or income. And so I think, you know, when people say, well, anybody could get a job, well, it's a lot harder for some of us than others. And we have to acknowledge that in the absence of decent, well-paying jobs, there's just chronic unemployment in African-American communities, poor communities. And in the absence of these jobs, some people are relying on the drug trade.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life outside or on the edge of the law in America's heavily policed inner cities, the underground economy and culture that millions now inhabit. A little police sound from Los Angeles behind us there. My guest today, Alice Goffman, spent 6 years in a tough neighborhood of Philadelphia. She's come out with the book On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City. She's a professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. The book's getting very strong reception for its vivid, intimate account of what it is like to live in this environment. Prisons are full, and that system reaches out into the community, makes just making a living, getting along very tough. Living as fugitive becomes almost the norm for many. Alice, questions for you here already. People come out at this right away and say, wait a minute. You know, why don't they go out and get jobs? Why don't they get the high school diploma? Can it really be that difficult?
Yeah. So let's take Tim. Tim is a younger brother of Chuck, who became a very good friend of mine in this neighborhood. And so Tim's first arrest came at age 11. He was stopped in a car that Chuck was driving. Chuck was driving him to school. The police stopped them. Ran the tags on the car, and the car came up as stolen in California. Chuck, like, had no idea which one of his girlfriend's relatives may have stolen the car. He was borrowing it from his girlfriend. But the police took the brothers into custody, charged Chuck with receiving stolen property, and then they charged Tim with accessory. And later a judge in the juvenile court placed him on 3 years of probation. He later went to juvenile detention for running away from his teacher. And so as the teacher was chasing him, his teacher pulled a hamstring, and then that became an assault charge. So we're talking about a level of kind of criminalization of very young people that I think makes it very hard to kind of go to school and graduate and get a job and lead a normal life. Mike's first arrest came at 13 when the police stopped, searched, and arrested him for carrying a small quantity of marijuana. So, you know, a lot of young people are smoking a little bit of pot or even harder drugs. Certainly on college campuses, there are fights, there's drug use, people are drunk driving, but those students are not coming out of college with criminal records and probation sentences and You know, they're coming out with college diplomas. So I think we need to think about fairness in the system and just what we are asking of African-American young men, how straight of a line we are asking them to walk.
Well, look at the drug business, how people try to avoid it, what happens when they're in it. But beyond that, as you tell the story of Chuck at the moment where he was just hungry, needed to do it, and so he did, wasn't happy about it. Beyond drugs, how do people make a living in this underground economy that you witnessed? What are the options?
Well, one thing that I discovered was that the number of people living with legal entanglements, court dates, probation, parole, halfway houses, house arrest, people living in prison, the number of people living with a kind of diminished citizenship in black neighborhoods, poor neighborhoods, is so great that it's actually spawned its own informal underground economy. So there's a large number of young people now who are, in the absence of decent well-paying jobs, eking out a living by providing services to all the people who are denied, you know, basic rights like leaving their house late at night or drinking alcohol or going to certain parts of the city.
So what kind of service industry is for those who are inhibited by what parole terms, let's say.
Exactly. So I met Javon when he was 8, and by the time he was like a very charismatic young boy, and by the time he was 13, his voice broke, and then he was able to impersonate his older relatives with like amazing accuracy. So he would do these impersonations of like movie stars or like his older cousin or his uncle. So one day Reggie is talking to me about his parole requirements, how he has to come home at 8 o'clock at night every night. And he really resents this because he's been locked up most of his life and he's just come home and now he can't go out after 8 o'clock. And he's fallen in love with this young woman a few blocks away. He really wants to go see her. She works until 8, so he can't go see her. So he's talking about living under the strain of these requirements. And Javon comes up to him and he's like, I could take that parole call for you, you know? Like, I could answer all the questions from the parole officer.
In your
I could
voice,
do your voice better than everybody.
You. Okay.
Exactly, exactly. So Reggie's like, well, hold on. Okay, what's my date of birth, you know? And Javon tells him. And he's like, okay, what was the first case I caught, you know? He's like, for weed when you were 10 years old, you know? And he's like, okay. And he starts asking him all these questions. Finally, he's like, all right, fine. So Reggie leaves that night. Javon is sitting in the house. The parole officer calls, asks him all kinds of questions. What was the, you know, what was the injury that you suffered for the last time you were incarcerated?
Yeah.
You know, and Javon answers it all perfectly. And then he keeps all the notes in a book so he can tell Reggie what to answer next time the parole officer calls. And so he starts out by charging $5 an hour, but then his mom urges him to charge he starts out by charging $5 a night, and then his mom is like, no, charge $5 an hour. You know.
Yeah.
So he starts providing the service for his uncle and then another cousin. There's people selling clean urine so people can pass their parole requirements, people selling fake documents. People who work in halfway houses are allowing men to leave at night and taking an extra $100 for that freedom. And then there's all the people working on the other side for the police, sort of providing information to the police as informants. So you have this whole economy around legal precariousness or people with diminished rights.
I want to look at informants. You also describe, if I remember correctly, a janitor who moonlights as a kind of backstreet unqualified doctor, but you're wounded, go to her.
Right. So one of the things I learned is that in the police's effort to round up enough men to make their informal stats and to take in as many people with low-level warrants or any kind of warrant as possible, they go to young men's places of work and also the places like their homes become a last known address. So like all the places that young men would normally go in order to be kind of good citizens and workers and stable family members like home, work, school, or the hospital when they are injured, that's where the police are looking for them. So in order to stay out of prison, young men have to kind of cultivate an unpredictability about their routine so that the police can't find them, which is, you know, in terms of incentives, we're setting up for people exactly the opposite of what we'd want to do. But anyway, yeah, so because the police are staking out hospitals and arresting people there, arresting black men there, running their names for warrants or pending charges, a lot of young men with warrants or with probation or parole are too scared to go to the hospital. And so So I saw many young men in the neighborhood get injured and then refuse to go and then find someone who works in healthcare, either as a janitor or maybe a nurse's assistant, someone who has access to medical supplies, come and fix them. So Ronnie had a gunshot wound in his leg and bled on the couch for a few days, refusing to go to the hospital because he had just gotten home from juvenile detention and he didn't want to go back and he thought this would result in a new charge. So then his mom found a woman who was working as a nurse's assistant, as a janitor, to come over and take the bullet out of his leg. So we turned up the music and he held on to a piece of cloth in his mouth and she took the bullet out right there on the kitchen table.
These are tasks that need doing. It hardly sounds like the makings of a thriving economy, but for many, it's what there is. Alice Goffman is with us. She's writing about a neighborhood in Philadelphia. It is a dynamic repeated right across the country. Her new book is On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City. Alice, stand by. Isaac is calling from Boston. Isaac, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Professor Kaufman, thanks for your work on this. I'm a retired Superior Court judge in Boston. I teach in law school, and I want to commend you for addressing these issues because one of the most frustrating things I saw as a judge was what I would call the pretend life, that we were supposed to pretend that all these wonderful legal principles in the Constitution and our statutes and good faith efforts were really going to resolve the problems that the professor refers to in her book, and they never do. And they won't unless we reprioritize how we handle this kind of a crisis.
What's the crisis, Isaac? Exactly. How would you define it?
Well, the crisis is marginalizing African American and Latino youth historically for decades, not focusing our resources on what would really help, but instead focusing them on creating what has become social institutions, prisons, courthouses and communities. And so the resources go to law enforcement and imprisonment as opposed to opportunity. And we, again, live under the pretend notion that these great principles in our Constitution are going to be enough. Or public policy pronouncements like, just get a job. If you get a job, everything will be fine. Or get an education. Anybody can go to Princeton. So we live that way without prioritizing our resources in a way that really helps these young people. This is all connected to issues of race.
That's right.
And gender to some degree, and also the way our school systems, for example, every study tells you, Tom and Professor Kaufman, that there's more police involvement in elementary and middle schools that serve African-American and Latino youth than white kids.
The police get
involved much more frequently. Police get called much more frequently. So you end up creating records for young people where normally in any other school system it would be dealt with differently and much more kindly, supportively. So my point is that the work of the professor and you're having this on air is fantastic because it helps me raise the point that I've always made as a judge and as a law professor, which is it's all well and good to have great principles and pretend that they affect everybody the same way. It's a different thing to put the resources where they ought to be.
Judge, retired Judge Isaac, we appreciate your call very much. Thank you.
Thank you so much for that. I'm just cheering over here.
What about awareness in this community where you were? Did people look around and say, this is wrong, this is messed up, this is unfair, this is unjust?
Yes, absolutely. So one halfway house operator who I got to know was letting men out at night. The people in his halfway house were, they had just come home from prison and they were sleeping way over capacity. He had problems with plumbing that he couldn't get fixed. So there was sewage on the floors and he was letting men out at night to see their families. And he compared what he was doing to an underground railroad. I mean, he really thought that this is about racial injustice and gross human rights violations. Mike's mother also took a very kind of political attitude. She would often say, Alice, Let me ask you something. When you go to the halfway house, why is it nothing but black and brown faces staring at you from behind the glass, you know? They're taking our children. They're taking our children, and that's not right. And I think she, like a lot of people, had a lot of kind of turmoil about this because, you know, she has family who works in law enforcement, and, you know, she believes in American society, and you know, she has an uncle who was a police officer. So kind of how the system what the system has become and what it's doing, you know, it was a real kind of it was hard for her to kind of wrap her head around how both of those things were happening, you know.
Let me go to Robin in New Orleans, Louisiana. Robin, thank you for calling. You're on the air with Alice Goffman.
Hi. Hi, Tom, and hi, Alice. Thank you for taking
my call. Hi, Robin.
Hey. So I live in New Orleans in a primarily African-American neighborhood, and I absolutely see what you're describing in Philadelphia. Kids at 13 and 14 are still kids, and then they disappear at 16. So, you know, I have several cases of children who I've known, and they're incarcerated in a kind of non-productive state. It's not, you know, it's not any kind of rehabilitation, and they tend to be kids with horrible mental health issues. And having dealt with crime from, you know, observing it, having been the victim of crime, I have actually, you know, pointed out this kid and that kid. Without knowing what to do, really, you know, working with law enforcement, you know, they're dangerous to themselves. And New Orleans is notoriously sort of bad on crime and law enforcement. But it's been so disappointing because I see some of these young guys as dangerous to themselves. The law enforcement that I've dealt with tend to be African-American. They seem to be harsher and less understanding of African Americans. Partially, it's almost like I feel there might be they're trying to prove that they're really hard on crime. Mm-hmm. And then nothing happens. Or just to wrap it up, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but it feels like there's an attitude towards young black kids that's like thin the herd.
Thin the herd of what, Robin?
Thin the herd, meaning that it's, you know, young black kids who have any kind of, you know, poverty or mental health issues, let them fall through the cracks. And literally, in New Orleans, I see that they'll be murdered or they'll be lost in the criminal justice system. And it's, and there's just not, there are no resources to help these kids.
Robin, our time is short before the break, but I so appreciate your call. Alice Goffman, there's firsthand observation and fear of an almost a, you know, just for starters, thin the herd, just to make it easier to deal with kind of mentality there.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, at the heart of this is American racism, which you know, from the work that I've done in Philly, I can tell you is alive and well. I think the question is, like, you know, how can we do better from here on out? And I think we're spending so much money on corrections, on the criminal justice system. You know, it's a lot less costly to incarcerate than it is to strengthen programs in communities, to provide job support, to help people stay in school, to help schools deal with behavior problems inside the school instead of pushing people into juvenile detention, young people. So I think, you know, right now, with budgets being very tight, you know, that's sort of on our side. I mean, I think it's become so incredibly costly to incarcerate this many black young people and young people, period, that, you know, there's this potential for reform. But I think what has to underlie that is a sense that that young people, that African-American young people are not criminals, you know, are people who are struggling and need support.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about life outside or on the edge of the law in America's heavily policed inner cities, the underground economy and culture that millions now inhabit there. Alice Goffman writes it up in her new book, On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. She joins us today from Philadelphia, where her research is based. Alice, let me go right to Nashville, Tennessee, if I may, and Cameron. Cameron, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, for taking my time here.
Sure.
I've been personally, since I was a young adult, just coming out of my teenage years, I've been in and out of the courts for like the past 6 years. The better part of my, young adult life has been trying to come out from under a felony charge. And I'm to the point now where, I've got a couple months left and it's like the pressure, it's really...
On parole, you mean?
Frightening me. I'm unaware of what's going to happen, and a lot of that comes from the fact that, meeting the guidelines from these paroles and probation is just, it's too hard, I'm supposed to maintain gainful employment and pay ridiculous amounts of fees, but no other job except these minimum wage jobs in Nashville, and then especially in the areas where I live, are the only ones that'll take me. And Nashville actually has one of the lowest, minimum wage.
Yes.
In the United States, it's very hard for me, someone like me who's got a little bit of an education, who, thinks well on his feet, who was in, just mixed up with the wrong people as a teenager, to really come out and battle back and try to get a leg up. For instance, when I was in the courts, as a teenager, I went through three different ROTC programs and had an opportunity to go to the military as a non-commissioned officer.
Okay.
And when I was in the courts, I pled that case with the judge, and I was like, look, hey, I'm actually a pretty good guy. Why don't you let me go, pursue the military? Look, I've got a background here saying that I'm already ready to go. And it was real, real disheartening to me, because the judge looked right at me and he kind of just laughed in my face. And he said, well, my son's in the military and he would never do anything like this, and denied me that right, So it's like, I've had to completely change my whole, career path. What am I going to do for a job? Here I am. I'm 27 years old now, and I'm just about to reach the end of it. But, it's held me down for so long. It's hard for me to think of where am I going to make my next move. If I get out from under this, what am I going to do?
Hey, Cameron, stand by. I'm glad you called and shared that. Alice, I wonder what's going through your mind. What's your question for Cameron?
Cameron, are you 3 months away from completing parole? Is that what you mean?
I am a couple months away from completing it. As far as
congratulations, you're so close. Yeah, we want to support you and celebrate you. It's tough, and you should be really proud.
Cameron,
I really want everyone else, who's listening, who maybe hasn't called in, who might be going through it, even though I've gone through a lot of hardships, I'm about to be at the end of it, so, it can definitely be done, But
Cameron, you described fees you have to pay, and you have to stay employed. If you fall out of employment, what happens?
Well, I can tell you right now, I just fell out of employment, not because of my lack of work skills or anything like that. A couple weeks ago, I was in the hospital. I do hard labor for work. It's pretty much the only field I can get work in with a felony background. A couple weeks ago, I was in the hospital and was diagnosed with Sherman's degenerative disc disease, where my back just gave out and my legs just stopped working. So I'm actually walking now, but I'm coming out from that and trying to pursue careers or jobs in other fields where I don't have to put so much stress on my back. And it's just nearly impossible with the background checks that I have to go through. Once I get to the background part, no one takes me serious, and it's just like, I've got a lot of educated people in my family. I've got my two older siblings, they've gone in the past, in the time that I've been in parole, they've gone from being teenagers to making $200,000 a year apiece. Unfortunately, they don't live near me, and it's hard for them to lend a helping hand. But I do have, on some level, some guidance from people who, are going and making good things in themselves, and I'm trying to get involved with people like that and latch onto those circles. And I think, that's the big part of what's been getting me through it is just me seeking out, you know, the right people, you know.
And Cameron, I so appreciate your call, and I almost hate to let you go because we can feel just how tenuous this can be, the challenges you're up against, but you're so close. Stay on the path, and we wish you very good luck on the other side. But I think you make it clear to us that there's no rosy scenario here. It's not easy on either side, but we wish you very good luck, Cameron. I appreciate your call.
Yeah, we sure do. We sure do.
Cameron, thank you for calling. Good luck. I wish I could offer more than that, but we do offer that. Carol in Perrysburg, New York. Carol, you're on the air.
Okay, I'll try and make this short. Mm-hmm. And hi, Tom.
Hi. Hi.
Say that. I'm from New York and Brooklyn, and my father was in family. And I live up in Perrysburg, New York, and there's a correctional facility up here, which I volunteered, and I chaired a Narcotics Anonymous group. And all of the guys, there were two white guys, and all the rest were African-American and Puerto Rican mix. And they all came from Brooklyn, and the family that I got involved with, and one of the men, he was a marvelous musician. Some of these, they were so intelligent, and they just, you know, it's like such a waste. And the young ones always say, oh, I'm never coming back here. But when they go back home, and I'm talking, home was Bedford Stuy,
yep.
And the family lived in the project, and some of these families, very solid people, and good people, and the apartments were neat, but the young men they can't get jobs. And what I thought when I went down there, my father came from that area. I knew something was familiar. The sycamore trees were familiar, and I said, oh my God, this is where my father was born. Mm. And the thing is, there's all these old brownstones, there's all these old homes that are crumbling. And I looked at that, and I thought, here are these young men who they had a college program in prison, and now they've cut that. And the ones that went into college were getting so proud. But anyway, what I thought was when I saw
we killed the Pell Grants in college. Go on.
So where are you going, Carol? What's your question or your observation here?
Where I'm going is we don't have any imagination because the young men that come out, if they come out, they're met by a drug dealer at the Port Authority at 11 o'clock at night when they get home, okay? And if there were programs where in their own neighborhoods, because these families had a pride in their apartments and but if they came back and there were programs to say, there's all these beautiful old brownstones, let's teach you how to fix up homes, that. It's staring you in the face. Because the neighborhoods are full of trash and barbed wire and this and that and the other thing.
But start somewhere. Carol, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Carol's thinking very practically about how to get people to work on something that would keep them out of the criminal side, which is pervasive there, out of the law enforcement side, which is pervasive there.
Can I get back to Cameron's question for a
minute?
Yeah,
please, please, yes.
Would you mind?
Not at all.
So Cameron, who we heard from before, I don't know if you're still listening, Cameron, but I just wanted to say thank you for that, and also that, you know, depending on the region, about half of people coming into prisons are people who are coming in not for new crimes but for technical violations of probation and parole, failing to get a job, failing a drug test or a urine test, being in a neighborhood that you're not designated to be, you know, not making curfew. And I think if we can transform probation and parole to be systems that are supporting young men, and women who are coming home or before people even go in or instead of going in, rather than creating a whole system that of hurdles and also the fees, right? So a lot of people are coming back for fees that they can't pay. So if we could transform these systems to be ones that support young people in their and older people coming home in their job search, rather than create a whole series of more regulations that they have to meet and fees that they have to pay, you know, that's like in some ways like a no-brainer, right? We could act right there. You know, Cameron shouldn't be struggling under these fees, you know, as he's trying to get a job. You know,
some people
have
described it as debtor's prison,
almost
as debtor's prison, because they can't pay the fees to get out, so you're in and boom.
Right, and you can actually work them off in jail and prison, so yeah.
I want to look at the family structure impact of the way women get caught up in this, and you have incredible stories here about the leverage, the pressure put on women to turn the men in their lives into law enforcement that put them in really difficult situations and end up breaking families.
Yeah, so like in order to round up enough young men to meet their informal quotas, the police are waiting outside of hospitals. They're running IDs of people on the street. They're stopping and searching people. But they're also deploying this very kind of almost kind of more pernicious strategy to make their stats, which is to turn to girlfriends, mothers, relatives to provide information about the whereabouts of the men in their lives. So this is not like the what the police do for like the few most wanted criminals, you know, where you find the person's girlfriend and say, okay, well, where is he hiding? This is what they're doing on a kind of routine basis to get large numbers of arrests from these communities. So we did this household survey of this neighborhood that I was living in Philadelphia, and we interviewed 146 men, 146 women, and 139 of those women said that they had been pressured by the police to inform on, to basically tell the police the whereabouts or activities of a husband or boyfriend or son.
And sometimes that within, pressure is very keen, very tough pressure.
Right. So I was present for a number of nighttime raids. One, you know, I was staying at Mike's mother's house, and Mike and Chuck had slept there that night. So it was me, Mike, Chuck, and Mike's mother. I was sleeping on the couch. And the police, three police officers in SWAT gear banged in the door. One put me in plastic cuffs, pushed me against the floor, put his foot on my back, asked me to tell him where the men in the house were. Then they opened the fridge. They pulled down the drop ceiling, took the squares out of the drop ceiling, mm-hmm. threw everything out of the closet, took a knife and opened everything in the couch. So after these raids, you know, your house is like, it's like a tornado hit your house, you know. So after that, women become much more cooperative, right? It's like, okay, well, the next time I see him, I'll call, you know. But they also do something kind of deeper than that, which is to tell women that they will take their children, or that they will lose all public housing privileges, or they will be arrested for the crimes that the man is being charged for. So women come to see their partners as people who might get them arrested, as people who they can't have in the house because they'll get evicted, or they'll get arrested themselves. So kind of ruining relationships from the inside out, which is again kind of the opposite of what we would like to see law enforcement doing. You know, we'd like the police to be strengthening relationships between men and women, not pulling men and women apart from each other.
Ira in Hartford, Connecticut. Ira, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, how you doing?
Pretty well, Ira. What do you know?
Yeah, well, you know, as a youth, I was incarcerated. I was always in the system. You know, I grew up with a mother that was drug addicted. And, you know, I can relate to being villainized, you know, for every little shortcoming that I had as a youth. And mm-hmm. It is possible to turn your life around.
Thank you. And how did you turn your life around?
It started, I went away for 6 years. I was incarcerated for 6 years at the age of 16. And during that incarceration, I was able to take a break away from the lifestyle that I was involved in. I was able to go to school, and I was able to get a GED and take, you know, various technical courses. And these are the things, you know, that helped me to, you know, develop. So I used that time incarcerated to get a better look at myself and to take a time out and make some decisions on what I wanted to do with my life.
Ira, did you go back to the same community when you came out, or did you go elsewhere?
Well, I went back to the same community, you know, but I knew that I had to change everything in order to succeed, you know. So I still remained friends with a lot of the people that I hung out with, but I kept a safe distance. Because of the teachings that I learned in Narcotics Anonymous, you have to change people, places, and things to the best of your ability.
Our time is short. I really appreciate your call. Alice,
people
want to hear this. They want to hear Ira's message. It is possible to turn your life around. I'm not sure the message of your book is quite that. Yours is more community-based and not quite as optimistic as Ira's direct personal message.
I think that there's a lot of people who want to be turning their lives around, and what we need to do is help people and not make it harder. I think that's really the message.
What would you do to do that? Our caller, you know, out of Brooklyn and Bed-Stuy said, have people come back and fix up brownstones. Okay. What would you do, Alice?
I mean, I think we need to think about, so, you know, crime is an undeniable problem in poor communities. It's something that residents have to deal with. We need to be providing solutions to crime that are not so arrest-based and so incarceration-based. We need to think about mediating disputes, think about the causes of crime, like some people mentioned. There's a lot of problems that are not really problems that should best be dealt with by imprisonment, problems like, not having finished school, problems like, not really knowing what to do when you're angry, problems like substance abuse. You know, these are all things that need community support, that need, people need help, not to be placed behind bars. I think also just we need to think more broadly about justice. We tend to think of justice in this very narrow way, you know, like it's unjust if you're wrongly convicted, but if you're convicted of something you did do, then you deserve to be punished for it. I think we need to think about justice and opportunities, justice for people who are trying to turn their lives around. How long should you continue to pay, after you've already been punished? Fairness under the law.
It is a big, deep circumstance that you describe here in Philadelphia and right on across the nation. You do it with a rare kind of intimacy. And we're grateful for the view, tough as it is. Alice Kaufman's new book is On the Run, Fugitive Life in an American City. Alice, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's been really terrific.
And listeners, thanks for all your contributions. Always appreciated. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.